Chamber of Commerce at 313-584-6100. The event is sponsored by Henry Ford Community College, your best choice guaranteed.
Brace yourselves, we've got Zubrin, and he's mad, this week on Planetary Radio. Hi everyone, welcome to Public Radio's travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. We talked to his 22nd century alter ego last week. This time, Robert Zubrin is very much in the here and now. You'll hear what the head of the Mars Society and author of The Case for Mars has to say about getting people to the red planet soon, really soon. Bill Nye, the science and planetary guy, is pretty darn enthused about an inflatable space module that might go to the International Space Station, while Emily Lakdawalla figures out why the landing space shuttle rattles windows and nerves not once, but twice. Then there's our friend Bruce Betts, who is on the History Channel this week. He'll give you another chance to win the universe in our What's Up segment. So much news that we don't have time for. Better read Emily's blog at planetary.org. Here's Bill.
Hey, Bill Nye, the planetary guy here, Vice President of the Planetary Society. And this week, I am excited about things that blow up. I'm not talking about explosions, destroying things. No, instead, I'm talking about spacecraft that inflate. So Robert Bigelow, who's a hotel owner in Las Vegas, has had this company for many years, and he proposes that we make spacecraft that inflate. These would be balloons in space. And he's tested a few of them. NASA rejected him back in the 1990s, but he tested a few of them on some Russian rockets, sent up a few living things. It worked okay. In fact, he claims that his inflatable spacecraft leak less than the International Space Station itself. Seems like an extraordinary claim, but I guess if the fabric's good and your O-rings, your seals are good, this kind of thing is possible. Now, no matter how well it works at some level, for me, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration should try this just because it's novel. It's new, and they're better in two ways, or they have advantages in two ways. The first is they're just made of fabric instead of metal and exotic materials and joining techniques, so you can make them more cheaply, at least you should be able to. Then the other thing is they weigh less. You don't make them into full-blown, pun intended, spacecraft until they're in orbit. So lifting them up into orbit is cheaper, or it should be. So no matter how well these things work, NASA should embrace this. They should try it because it's new and cool and it might open up a whole new world. This would be a direct spinoff. This isn't, well, you know, heat shield technology developed for the astronauts helps your coffee stay hotter. No, this is a direct spacecraft developed with citizens' money that may enhance the life of people everywhere by making space more accessible. So if you're a Planetary Society member, thanks for supporting this. And if you're not a Planetary Society member, thanks for listening, because you're indirectly supporting space exploration. Well, I gotta fly. Bill Nye, the Planetary Guy.
Robert Zubrin wants to go to Mars, and he thinks we can get there a lot sooner than NASA thinks we can. He is renowned for his passion and his ability to generate enthusiasm or resentment, depending on who you're talking to. He co-founded the Mars Society in 1998, not long after he wrote The Case for Mars, in which he laid out what he and collaborators believed was an ambitious but achievable plan for sending humans to the red planet. As you're about to hear, he's still very much a believer. He spoke to me from his engineering firm, Pioneer Astronautics, in Colorado. Robert, welcome back. Or I should just say welcome. I forgot that was just your 22nd century namesake that we had on the show last week. Let's start with what's been most in the news lately about manned spaceflight. Everyone outside of NASA calls it the Augustine Commission, though the official name is the Review of Human Spaceflight Plans Committee. You testified before the group in August. The commission has now released its summary report. Where does that leave you? Satisfied? Disgusted? Amused?
I think this report was a major disservice to the Obama administration and to the nation. because basically what they laid before the president were a set of options, all of which involved NASA's human spaceflight program accomplishing nothing at a cost of over $100 billion for the next decade, which is incredible, frankly. To ask for $100 billion and deliver nothing and not have any provision for delivering anything, to me, is beyond belief. And frankly, I think it places the human spaceflight program in danger, because the administration would be more than justified in looking at the options that they're being presented with to reject all of them and simply decide to wind the whole thing up. If, on the other hand, they decide to go with one of the commission's recommendations, then we get a spaceflight program that spends $100 billion and doesn't do anything for another decade or two. The idea of continuing to spend $9 billion a year on a human spaceflight program, $18 billion for NASA as a whole, but here we're just talking about the human spaceflight program, which has no objectives, which has no intention of getting anywhere anytime soon, but is simply engaged in a random walk of simply sort of doing things because it's there. Well, let's go up and down to the space station. Why? Well, we don't know. But as long as we built it, we might as well go to it. I mean, this is nonsense. What we need, first of all, in order to get anywhere, you have to have a definite goal. Otherwise, you're engaged in a random walk, which is what NASA's human spaceflight program has been doing since 1973. And secondly, you have to have a schedule that requires you to pay attention to your goal. You know, the Augustine Commission says our goal should be Mars, but they have no schedule or any provision for getting there for the next several decades. So this is not really a goal. It's a dream. Okay, a goal is something that you, if it's truly your goal, you direct your actions towards getting there. And there's no provision in this report for doing that. They do recommend continuing with a heavy lift program, although one cannot understand why, given that there's no need for a heavy lift vehicle if we're not going anywhere beyond low Earth orbit. So then you get into the idea of let's have a heavy lift program that goes on for 20 years because it's not needed for 20 years. So you spend $3 billion a year for 20 years, well, that's $60 billion, I mean, which is ridiculous. Whereas if you did what Kennedy did, which is what Obama needs to do, which you set a real goal, and you set a schedule associated with that goal that forces people to pay attention to that goal. In Kennedy's case, it was by the end of the decade, reach the moon. Okay, in Obama's case, it should be by the end of his second term, reach Mars. And then instead of people, you know, engage in a random walk doing any number of programs because they feel like it, they engage in a concerted effort. You design a hardware set that is capable of fulfilling that mission. You issue requests for proposals for fixed price contracts to develop each element of that hardware set within a specified time, and then you go and get to Mars. That's what they need to do. Otherwise, I mean, this is a travesty.
So you would like to see, before the end of a second Obama administration, less than 8 years from now, you'd like to see humans walking on Mars?
Yeah, sure. Look, from despite all the problems that someone might raise, some of which are real and others of which are overdrawn, we're much closer today to being able to send humans to Mars than we were able to send men to the moon in 1961 when Kennedy started the moon program, and we were there 8 years later. If we, in fact, had leadership, okay, and commitment, we could be on Mars within 8 years. It is, for our day and age, it is a smaller technical challenge than going to the moon was in 1961, a considerably smaller technical challenge, I might add. And so for us to say this is beyond our capability is basically us saying that we're no longer the people we used to be. And that is really something this country cannot afford.
You said Mars is in the Augustine summary report. In fact, here's the language. Mars is the ultimate destination for human exploration, but it is not the best first destination. And then, of course, they talk about first the moon or maybe someplace else. I don't know that it's named, but a lot of people talk about an asteroid. Do you see any value in that, or should we just go, if you'll pardon the expression, Mars direct?
Mars direct. Look, if you want to go to Mars, you need to go to Mars. If you, you know, this is the same thing we had with the shuttle program, which is let's just do this program. And it's true the shuttle doesn't actually go anywhere, but trust us, the capability we develop with the shuttle will stand us in good stead when at some time in the future we actually decide to go someplace. And then they said the same thing with the space station. Well, the space station doesn't actually go anywhere, but trust us, the experience we get with the space station will be of great use when we actually decide to go somewhere. So now here's the Augustine report, or before then the Bush people, saying, well, we want to go to the moon, and the space station is of no use whatsoever for going to the moon, but do we disengage from it immediately and look really stupid for having spent all this money on a station that we're not going to use, or do we use it for the hell of it to say that we have at least used what we built and then abandon it? No, if you want to go to Mars, you need to go to Mars. Now, if you say, look, we're going to go to Mars in 8 years, and here's our hardware set, and it is to our benefit in the course of a well-planned Mars program to exercise a subset of the Mars hardware by going first to Earth orbit with it and then going to a near-Earth asteroid with it, well, if the budget permits and schedule permits and it all makes sense to actually do that, and if the risk mitigation associated with going to near-Earth asteroid is greater than the risk associated with the asteroid mission itself, because after all, such a mission is not risk-free either, then you might decide to do that. But you don't say, well, we'll see about going to an asteroid sometime in the mid-2020s, and that's a good thing for us to do next, and maybe sometime in the future someone will go to Mars. Mm. We're not going to get to Mars that way. You actually have to decide that Mars is the goal, and then you do the set of activities required to get to that goal, and that may or may not include an asteroid mission, but it's decided within that context.
It's on the timeline, and that timeline ends at Mars.
That's right.
Don't leave now. Robert Zubrin of the Mars Society will be back with me in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here. I hope you're enjoying Planetary Radio. We put a lot of work into this show and all our other great Planetary Society projects. I've been a member since the disco era. Now I'm the Society's vice president. And you may well ask, why do we go to all this trouble? Simple. We believe in the PB&J, the passion, beauty, and joy of space exploration. You probably do too, or you wouldn't be listening. Of course, you can do more than just listen. You can become part of the action, helping us fly solar sails, discover new planets, and search for extraterrestrial intelligence and life elsewhere in the universe. Here's how to find out more.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. No one wants to get humans to Mars more than Robert Zubrin, and no one has worked harder or ruffled more feathers pushing for this goal. The nuclear and astronautics engineer has written many books, including The Case for Mars, and he remains the president of the Mars Society, a group he founded more than 10 years ago. He is not happy with the summary report by the so-called Augustine Commission issued a couple of weeks ago, and he is even less happy with what he sees as NASA's lack of focus on meaningful goals for humans in space. Just one other reference to the Augustine Commission, because you wrote about 3 weeks ago now, as this is heard, that you had reviewed some of the figures, some of the cost estimates for heavy lift launch vehicles that were provided to the commission by the Aerospace Corporation, and you really take issue with those figures.
Yeah, they're absurd. The cost estimates in the industry for developing a heavy lift launch system range between $2.5 and $5 billion. You know, Elon Musk, in fact, directly went to the commission and offered to develop a heavy lift system for $2.5 billion. I've seen Lockheed Martin presentations in which they say they could develop a heavy lift launch system for $4 billion. So instead, they get this estimate from the Aerospace Corporation, which is, well, a heavy lift vehicle. A program to develop that would cost around $3 billion a year to run, and if we take 12 years to develop it, there's $36 billion. Well, you know, in other words, if you view this as if you're buying a house that has to be built as opposed to one that's already there, you say, okay, Mr. Builder, how much are you willing to build this house for me? And he comes in with a bid, and you check with some other people, and then you take a bid for a given house. You don't say, well, how much will you build this house? He says, well, I charge $100,000 a year, and I'm not exactly sure when we'll finish, but maybe in a decade, maybe in two decades. So it'll be $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, depending upon when you decide to stop our building program. Okay, and look, the proof of what I'm saying can be arrived at immediately. All NASA has to do to get a heavy lift vehicle for under $5 billion is put out a request for proposals to industry who will build a heavy lift system for us within 5 years for $5 billion or less. Gentlemen, place your bids. And they would get bids from every major and minor aerospace contractor, and they'd need to be able to select among those and award a fixed price contract to develop the heavy lift vehicle. That $36 billion number is totally off the chart. And it was either simply accepted mindlessly, or it was accepted with intent of having an excuse to kill, well, in this case, the moon program. These guys did want to decouple from the moon program the Bush people had, which I would have done so too, but not to simply say, let's go nowhere, but rather to say, okay, let's embrace a real objective for the space program, which is Mars.
So much more to talk about. I always have been very proud that I was there when you made the first public presentation of what you and your colleagues called the Mars Direct Plan. What's the status? Still alive and kicking?
Well, the Mars Direct Plan still stands there as a challenge. If you want to go to Mars, this is how you could do it with present-day technology, with a transportation system that is of the same magnitude and complexity as a lunar transportation system. It is not an order of magnitude greater. It has a few extra elements. It also has a couple of fewer elements that the moon needs that it doesn't. But it's basically the same kind of thing. So it really puts Mars in our age of engineering, not in some future age. Okay? In other words, humans to Mars is a task for our time. If you're going to go to Mars, you plan it for us to do it within 8 to 10 years, and for the mission to be flown by people who are in the astronaut corps today, not by people who haven't been born yet.
You and about 700 other would-be Martians put the Mars Society together in 1998. And we've talked about this. We've talked about you passionate folks for Mars. I hope I can count myself among them. With Andrew Chaikin, who wrote about you and other Mars pioneers in his recent book, A Passion for Mars. I wonder, do you find in that group that you are still among the most passionate?
Well, I think there's plenty of people, both in the Mars Society and not in the Mars Society, who are passionate about reaching for the red planet, because we know this is where we will discover whether life is unique to the Earth or a general phenomenon in the universe, and whether life as we know it on Earth is the pattern for all life everywhere, or just one particular example from a much vaster tapestry of possibilities. And this is where we will discover whether we are capable of becoming a multi-planet species, because Mars is the planet that has the resources to support life and therefore potentially civilization. So Mars is the challenge before us. It holds the secret of the nature of life in the universe, and it holds the secret of our future in the universe. And that is where we need to go. And to take any other objective of, you know, returning to the moon on the half-century anniversary of when we were there last, great nostalgia trip, or going to a Lagrange point where there is, after all, nothing, these are not embracing challenge. These are avoiding challenge. And the space program was not set up to avoid challenge. You know, Kennedy said we choose to go to the moon and do other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. So we need a space program that embraces challenge. That's the kind of space program that's going to inspire our youth to want to enter science in millions. Okay, and that's the kind of space program that will actually accomplish something. If the American people want to get a return for their space dollar, we have to have a space program with objectives. Okay, the Augustine Commission, by saying, well, you know, why don't you give NASA $3 billion extra a year, but, you know, lay off on actually demanding that it accomplish anything within your 2 terms, Mr. Obama, assuming you have them, plus the term or two after that, is just such a disservice.
Robert, we are out of time. I hope we can talk to you again. It's always enjoyable and inspiring to talk to someone who speaks with such passion about a goal that I think most of the listeners to this radio show share.
Right. If people want to know more about Mars exploration, I've got a book called The Case for Mars. And if people want to have a humorous take on Mars settlement, I have a newer book called How to Live on Mars,
well,
Guide to Immigrants.
In fact, listen to this little bio that I'm going to close with. Robert Zubrin is the co-developer of the Mars Direct Plan and the author of that bestseller, 1996, The Case for Mars, still out there. He's founder and president of the Mars Society and president of Pioneer Astronautics, based in Colorado, which is where we are speaking to him today. Dr. Zubrin is a recipient of the National Space Society's Robert A. Heinlein Award, but he has no provable relationship with another Robert Zubrin, who will be born on Mars in the year 2071, later to write How to Live on Mars, a trusty guidebook to surviving and thriving on the red planet. That book is available in our century from Three Rivers Press, and I highly recommend it. And I highly recommend that you stick around for this week's edition of What's Up. That's right after we hear from Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily Lakdawalla with Questions and Answers. This time, I'm answering my own question. When Space Shuttle Discovery landed at Edwards Air Force Base, I stood outside to listen for its boom. I was surprised to hear a boom boom. The reason for there being any sonic boom is because the shuttle is outrunning its own noise. Sound travels through the air as pressure waves. When an aircraft moves faster than the expansion speed of those waves, the wave fronts pile up in a cone shape that expands aftward, much like the wake of a speedboat. The overlapping wave fronts reinforce each other and manifest as a big, sharp pressure wave, resulting in the boom sound. Supersonic aircraft actually create many bow waves from all of their little protuberances, but all the little waves usually merge to form two big ones. One sonic boom forms at the nose of the aircraft. The second boom is created behind the aircraft, where air rushes in to fill the void left by the aircraft's passage. The air can only flow in so fast. The faster the aircraft is traveling, the farther behind it the second boom is. If the aircraft is moving relatively slowly, just over the speed of sound, we usually hear only one bang. But if the aircraft is moving more quickly and the two sonic booms are separated by more than a tenth of a second, we'll hear it as two separate booms. Got a question about the universe? Send it to us at planetaryradio@planetary.org. And now here's Matt with more Planetary Radio.
Got Bruce Betts on the cell phone. No opportunity for Skype this week. He's on the road, obviously. It's time for What's Up. He's going to tell us about the night sky and another great prize that we have for the Space Trivia Contest this week. Hello, and tell us where you are.
I am standing in a theater on stage right now and performing this live in front of a lot of chairs.
Not exactly your dream, but I hope it's just a rehearsal.
Yes, indeed it is. These two radio hosts walk into a bar.
I've heard that one.
Oh, and we'll move on to the night sky. In the night sky, we've got Jupiter in the evening, the seriously bright-looking thing over there in the western sky after sunset. And in the pre-dawn, Venus still for a little bit longer, looking extremely bright. Up above it, high in the sky right now, is Mars, looking reddish. It'll keep getting brighter as it heads towards opposition in a couple months. Other host of planets coming up in the low in the morning sky, but I'm going to wait another week, I think, and then fill you in on that as they get closer.
Jupiter is just looking outstanding. I pointed it out to my wife while we were driving yesterday, and I'm not even sure she looked up, actually, but I was impressed.
Probably she's just stares at it so frequently that it, well, I don't know. I got nothing. Let's go on to this week in space history. 35 years ago, in 1974, if I've done my math right, Mariner 10 had its second flyby out of three past Mercury. Particularly appropriate because the Messenger spacecraft, in another week and a half here, will do its third flyby of Mercury, giving us more views and all sorts of other data. Rather exciting. Its last flyby as it gets ready to go into orbit 2011 and give us our first Mercury orbiter.
We'll check back in on that mission as we have in the past.
On to Random Space Fact!
You know, it really is a shame that this is on the cell phone because we only got just the lightest taste of the ambience there in that theater that you're in.
Did you hear the applause?
In my head, yes.
That's where I heard it. Yes. So we're talking destruction. Destruction, destruction. We'll talk more about it in a moment. 4.5 billion years ago. You remember that time, right?
Like yesterday.
Yeah, and you're hanging out on the proto-Earth, and this big Mars-sized object comes slamming into Earth, and what comes spewing out? But the material that forms the moon. Yes, that's right, folks. That's where we think the moon formed, and here's a bonus. It also then, as it accreted all the chunks that came flying off that didn't come back and accreted into the moon, the moon went molten, and you had the light stuff floating up and the heavy stuff floating down, and it was a whole formation of the Earth-Moon system. And it happened this week. It's an effort.
This week in history. Speaking of history, we're going to get into that, aren't we, with the trivia contest?
We are indeed. Why don't we do the last trivia contest first?
Sure.
And then we'll move on. See, we played one of my favorite games, because it's my rules. Where in the solar system? We asked you, where in the solar system, not on Earth, can you find a planetary feature called Hamlet?
You know, we got a terrific response. The response had been down a little bit. It really bounced back with this one. Must be a lot of Shakespeare fans out there. Everybody got it right, and that's pretty amazing with so many responses. Lindsay Dawson, who could always be counted on for something interesting, mentioned that Oberon to the west of Sydney, Australia, near where he lives, is in the Blue Mountains, and it's quite possible that someone named Hamlet once lived there. But he and our winner both also provided the correct answer, the one that we were looking for. Our winner is Walt Sherry of Mile Ranch, 108 Mile Ranch, British Columbia. I bet that's a pretty place. And Walt said, Hamlet is the largest crater on the moon Oberon that orbits Uranus.
Yay!
So, Walt, we're going to send you a Planetary Radio T-shirt and an Oceanside Photo and Telescope Rewards card. Bruce, I guess everything out there is very Shakespearean.
It is. It's the major naming theme for the satellite there. So, yeah, to be or not to be, Oberon is the answer.
Okay, now on to the history part, really more of the History Channel part.
Yes, indeed. So there's the History Channel series, The Universe, has an episode, starts airing this week on Tuesday night at 9 Pacific and Eastern, on 10 ways to destroy the Earth.
Who did they go to, pray tell, to provide this cataclysmic information?
Clearly, that would be something that they would go to experts for, and if they can't get them, they came to me.
So our man Bruce, this week on the History Channel, and you know the History Channel, they'll repeat it unendingly, infinitely almost, throughout the week and probably beyond. So you probably still have a chance to see it. But we have another first season, entire collection of the first season episodes on DVD. No, I'm sorry, on Blu-ray, to give away. And all you have to do is answer this question that Bruce is about to pose.
I'm going thematic. I'm going to challenge people a little bit. What would be your favorite way to destroy the Earth? As usual, it's highly professional, so try to make us laugh.
Trying to make us laugh, exactly. So probably the 10 that are identified in the episode of The Universe will not be a win.
Well, it depends on how you phrase them. Some of them are out there. It's interesting. The good news, by the way, for those worrying at home, is that the 10 discussed really have so very little possibility of happening. But what's interesting is the cool physics that comes out of looking at those wacky things. Get to us with cool physics or just wacky. And go to planetary.org/radio, find out how to enter and compete for your chance to win a Blu-ray season one of The Universe.
And do that by the 28th of September at 2 p.m. Pacific time. That's Monday, September 28th. We're done.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up the night sky, and think about all those lights hanging over your head in theaters and whether they're really firm or not. Thank you, and good night.
This is one of my worst nightmares, you know, because I've spent a lot of time in television studios, and I always had this fear that this is how my life would end, with one of those 2K spots coming down on my head.
Take heart, there's still time.
He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society. He comes crashing down on us every week here for What's Up. Is it the heat shield that will get humans to Mars? We'll ask its creators on our next show. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California. Keep looking up. J.
join us this Saturday, October 3rd, for the second annual WHFR Record Show, featuring thousands of records, CDs, videos, and other music memorabilia for sale right here at Henry Ford Community College in the Student Center building. The show runs from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. A $1 to $5 donation to the station is recommended for admission. For more details, visit the website whfr.fm/recordshow. See you this Saturday, October 3rd.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a Friend of HFCC Theater, call 313-845-6478.
Looking for the perfect gift for your Henry Ford Community College student? Try a HFCC gift certificate. Available in any size to fit any student. They're perfect for birthdays, weddings, or any other special occasions. Gift certificates can be purchased at the cashier's office and can be redeemed anywhere on campus. HFCC gift certificates. Easy to buy, easier to use.
I'm trying to use the phone!
Hey, loyal listener. Call WHFR at 313-845-9676. Or toll free at 1-800-585-HFCC, extension 9676.
What? What? I couldn't hear that last part.
That's 845-9676 or toll free 1-800-585-HFCC, extension 9676.
Check out the WHFR message forum at www.whfr.fm. It's a place to discuss all sorts of topics, ranging from movies and music to upcoming events and even just happy thoughts. Place requests, make comments, or just say hi on the WHFR message forum at www.whfr.fm.
Radio fans, Imagination Works has been revamped. Are you familiar with radio drama? If not, become acquainted with old-time radio mysteries on WHFR, Late Night Monday, 11 p.m. until midnight. Hear The Mysterious Traveler, The Inner Sanctum, Suspense, and much more. Hear classic radio drama on Monday nights, 11 p.m. until midnight, on the station making waves, 89.3.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Josh Tickell about his new documentary film, Fuel, Uncovering America's Dirty Little Secret. We'll get some political commentary from the Sierra Club's executive director, Carl Pope, and author Elizabeth Marshall Thomas will talk with us about her new book, The Hidden Life of Deer. We'll also get an update on clean cars from Sierra Club expert Ann Mesnikoff in D.C., and chef Annie Somerville from Green's Restaurant gives us some green cooking tips. Joining us now is filmmaker Josh Tickell to talk about his new documentary, Fuel, Uncovering America's Dirty Little Secret. And we're thrilled to have him joining us today. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Orly.
So, Josh, a lot of people have been talking about this film for a really long time. There's a lot of buzz about it. How did you first decide to make this film, and what inspired you to do a documentary about fossil fuels?
The story is really a personal one. It comes from having grown up in the oil refinery area of Louisiana and having seen members of my family get sick from the acute pollution. You know, that area of the country is called Cancer Alley. There are over 150 petrochemical facilities there, and it's largely unchecked even by today's EPA. So we find these, you know, huge industrial areas producing our nation's energy, and then when it hits a personal note, when somebody you know is sick or you get sick, and you live next to one of these facilities, you wonder, okay, is that what's making me sick? And so as a kid, I really looked at that and began to wonder, what about green energies? What about ways of living in harmony with the planet so that the air and the water and the soil and ultimately our food supply isn't damaged by our need for energy?
And so what inspired you to create this film? I know you've been working on it for a really long time, I think 11 years, is that right?
That's correct.
So how did you first decide, I'm going to jump in, make a film about this, and how did you get started?
Well, I actually started by giving talks and giving lectures and doing research on the area of energy, and then wrote a couple of books on the subject and realized that, you know, for today's audiences to communicate a message and to have the kind of groundswell of interest, not just the problems, because we all hear the problems, and we're like immune to the problems, you know? Oh, my God, I don't want to hear about another oil spill or chemical thing or this or that. It's so just part of the noise. I wanted to create a communications platform to really have a national dialogue about solutions. Now, what do we do now? What can I do as an average person today that will make a difference for me and for my family and my community and ultimately for my kids? That's what I wanted to have a national dialogue about. And, of course, times have changed over the past 11 years, some for the worst in the past and perhaps some for the better today. But we still lack this powerful national dialogue that goes down to a community level about green solutions. And so the film is really an access for that.
Let's talk about some of those solutions. What do you see as being our best solution in terms of alternative energy, and what are some of the ways that you tackle this in the film?
Well, certainly, you know, the most practical solution that we have and the cheapest one is energy efficiency and conservation. And people are starting to hear that now. It's, you know, even in Los Angeles here, we're starting to see billboards about saving water. You know, what a concept, a city in the desert saving water. So it's eking into the public conscience, but it hasn't really taken a strong foothold yet in the way that it probably should to move the nation toward green energy. You know, per dollar spent, it costs about $5 to $10 less per kilowatt to save a kilowatt than it does to make a new green kilowatt. So we have the most potential for success at a home level, at a community level, and at an industrial level by looking at inefficiencies. And that at your home can be as simple as literally going around your house in the summer or the winter, depending on what kind of climate you live in, and looking for cracks around doors. If you can slip a piece of paper, you know, through a crack in a doorway, that means there's air passing through it. The same with exterior windows. So Americans tend to lose between 30 and 40% of their electricity bill every year to inefficient heating and cooling. So there's a lot of simple things that you can do. And we highlight them briefly in the movie, but they can actually put money back in your pocket. And that's a really exciting thing about the solutions in fuel. You can actually make money from this.
Do you have a favorite moment in the film?
Do I have a favorite moment in the film? For me, yes, I do. I like the end of the movie. And, you know, I hate to give away the end of a story before you've seen it, but I will say a couple of things about it. And that is, you know, the end of the movie is very Kennedy-esque. It's about the power that we have as individuals to change the way the collective is going. So how do I change where San Francisco is going, or how do I change where Washington is going, or how do I change where the whole nation is going? And the truth is, we have that kind of power, but it's largely unused. And so the end of the movie, it brings that home in a clear message, and it's very emotional. I love it. Most other people, they like the middle of the movie. They like the personal story that I take, where I start out and I fight oil companies and they are evil and I'm going after them. And there's a transition in the middle of the movie where, in reality, I get that that's not the way that we're going to make change. And there's a personal revelation where I say I stopped fighting from anger and I started looking for partners. And ironically enough, here we have ExxonMobil now just put $600 million into algae fuel technology. So those partnerships are starting to occur.
Did the oil industry fight you at all in making this film? Did you have any challenges, external challenges in that sense?
We did have external challenges making the movie, especially filming the movie. We filmed a lot in Louisiana around the oil refineries. We filmed in California around oil refineries. We were almost arrested several times by unmarked police that were hired by oil companies but were driving things like ambulances. At one stage, the FBI was contacted, and we were held for quite some time. So it was touch and go, especially during the time, the last 11 years, when we were making the movie. I think now, you know, while some of the issues persist in fuel, you know, we really do show, hey, look, here's the real deal in terms of where the oil industry's at. This is, you know, we don't sugarcoat it, and we don't go in with guns blazing, but we do show the truth. And some of that hasn't changed, and it needs to, because there's a national health risk that we take in using so much petroleum and in refining it the way we do. But I will say this, that some of the challenges we faced in making the movie have radically shifted, and the perception from the energy companies toward green energy and toward green energy advocacy has shifted, and I think it's going to very much shift after the national release of the movie Fuel.
Now, Fuel won the Audience Award at Sundance. So what was that like for you, and what effect did it have on the movie?
It was an incredible experience, first of all, as an independent filmmaker. You know, foremost, I consider myself an environmental activist and will always consider myself that. So that taints people. Some people don't go see the movie because they're like, oh, he's another Al Gore, or he's an Al Gore wannabe. For some people, it's a draw, but it's who I am. So for me, stepping into the role of filmmaker and receiving that award was validation that there was a message wrapped into a movie that was powerful just as a movie. You could go watch it. Audiences at Sundance, they are so incredibly critical that they loved this movie, and they were waiting in the snow, hundreds of them, and they couldn't get in. So that was incredible just to say, okay, we've made something that really moves people emotionally. You know, it's powerful. It's entertaining. It was also interesting for the movie in that 48 hours after receiving the award, you know, Science Magazine published two articles condemning biofuels for the world, and that turned into a media flurry that turned into a meeting in Rome with the United Nations where biofuels were blamed for the world food shortage. And, you know, first of all, that's not what caused the world food shortage. Rising oil prices that created a rise in food prices that created a shortage created the world food shortage. So it was oil, not biofuels. So when we saw that, we went, oh, my God, we didn't cover this in the movie. And it's so pivotal. It's so important that Americans understand that, you know, while they often blame, you know, the good because it's not perfect, we sacrifice the progress toward good. You know, we sacrifice the progress toward green energy because it's not perfect. Meanwhile, what's really causing the problem is a petroleum-based economy. So we went, right, we've got to go refilm. We've literally got to cut the movie in half and film another half of the movie. So we did. We cut the movie in half and filmed a whole new second half, reanimated the film, and re-sound designed the movie. So the final movie, Fuel, is actually an advanced new version that encompasses all these new green solutions, algae, everything, that wasn't at Sundance, but it still has that personal journey and all of the heart and all of the entertainment and all of the emotion, too.
So where can our listeners go to see the film?
Well, it's opening nationwide. It's starting its opening on September 18th in San Francisco, Washington, D.C., New York, and then it's going to be rolling out to cities across the nation. And the best way to get more information about the movie is to go to the website at thefuelfilm.com. That's thefuelfilm.com. And you can actually request, if you're a theater owner or a theater manager, you can request it come to your theater. If you're not, and you suspect it may not come to your theater, we have directions on there for how to get involved as an ambassador for the movie to get it to play in your local theaters. Because when something goes into theaters, as you know, Orly, it is really a powerful statement as to the importance of the message. So we're committed to go there first. Of course, it'll eventually be on DVD and all of that good stuff. But right now, it's an exciting time, and it's imperative. People need to go see the movie, because when you go see the movie, your ticket is a vote. It's a vote for green energy, and it's a vote to have a real, genuine national dialogue, because even though we've got a new energy plan that's coming online and a new Clean Air Act, those are riddled with problems. And the coal industry, the nuclear industry, the natural gas industry, and certainly the oil industry have their tentacles deep, deep within those plans. So America still is a long way from taking a stand for these issues. This is a movie that lets you take a stand with your family and your friends. Take them, and you can have that message be clear for everybody.
Now, what about teachers who might want to use a, you know, an educational version of this film in their classroom? Is that happening at the same time as the theatrical release, or do they have to wait till later? How does that work?
The way it works is we have a separate nonprofit entity that is licensing an educational version of the movie, which will be made available free specifically to teachers so they can show it in classrooms. And that 35-minute version will be available on a website called curriculumhub.com. That's curriculumhub.com. Of course, you can just go to the fuelfilm.com website, thefuelfilm.com, and you can click straight through to the educational version right there. But obviously, having this information in schools is imperative.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Josh Tickell talking about his new documentary, Fuel, Uncovering America's Dirty Little Secret.
This is Carl Pope from the Sierra Club. You wouldn't know it looking at Congress struggle, but America is getting off our dependence on oil and coal. In the last month alone, there have been extraordinary events, events that show we're on a pathway that could solve global warming. First, the figure to remember, 200 million tons. To cut our global warming by 80% by mid-century, this country needs to cut our projected emissions rate by 200 million tons of CO2 each year. That's the nut we have to make. So last month, what happened? Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad announced it would abandon its proposed new rail line. The line was to bring 100 million tons of coal, emitting, yes, 200 million tons of CO2 a year from Wyoming to coal plants in the Midwest. The Sierra Club's been fighting this coal line for 7 years, and now, in one big step, we've made the progress America needs in 2009. But there's more. Experts for the state of Wyoming conceded that that state, which produces more coal than any other in America, may have hit peak coal. Wyoming's coal production in 2008 is down from 2007. 2009 looks lower yet. States like California, Washington, and Oregon that used to purchase coal-fired electricity from Wyoming are shifting to renewables and high-performance efficiency. These states just don't need Wyoming's coal by wire anymore. And to the east, the same trend. Michigan just announced that it doesn't need for at least 18 years two new coal-fired power plants that have been under review by state regulators. Congress may not get it yet, but America, we're still moving towards a clean energy future. This is Carl Pope for the Sierra Club.
We are here now with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, the author of a new book called The Hidden Life of Deer, Lessons from the Natural World. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I guess let's start by just talking about what made you decide to write a book specifically about deer.
Well, I live in New Hampshire, and we had a very bad winter, 2007-2008. When there was a lot of snow, but no acorns, which fatten the deer so that they can survive the winter. And without the acorns, they were starving, so I began to feed them corn. And I know you're not supposed to do that, but I didn't care. And what I learned from watching them was just enormous to me. And I mean, I've been interested in animals all my life, and I do feel I know something about animals, but I was just astonished by what the deer showed me. So that was a very good thing for me, and good for them too, because a lot of them survived that would not have survived because of the corn that I gave them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background. Now, you've also written books called The Hidden Life of Dogs and Tribe of the Tiger. How did you become a naturalist? What first got you interested in writing about the animal world?
Well, I can't remember a time when I wasn't. I've always been interested in the animal world. But I think it when I was about 19, my father and mother and my brother and I went to the Kalahari Desert to study a group of hunter-gatherers who lived in the interior that at the time was unexplored, and it was pre-contact times for the people that we visited, a group of Bushmen. And
were your parents anthropologists?
My mother was, yes. My dad was a civil engineer and became an explorer at that point. And what I learned was how it is to survive in the natural world. What do you have to do to survive like that? There were people who were living solely from the savannah. They didn't have, they had nothing, no manufactured items, no domestic animals, no plants, no domestic plants. They lived only from the natural world. And all creatures who live in what I call the old way live in that manner. And it became very interesting to me to see how other kinds of creatures other than people did it. And so that was what sparked all this writing about them.
Well, the deer issue is very interesting, because I think so many people, especially in the Northeast, where it's very very populated, people don't think of themselves as living in a wild place. People who are living in New Jersey, New York.
We don't live in a wild state at all. We did for 150,000 years when our ancestors were African savanna, part of the African savanna fauna. That's how we started as people. But we haven't lived like that since agricultural times.
Well, but that's what's so interesting to me about deer specifically, because people think of themselves as living in this completely industrial developed world and there's no wild animals anywhere left.
Yes.
And yet, for so many people, there are wild deer wandering in their backyard. Now,
exactly.
What do you think our listeners would be most surprised to learn about deer?
About deer? Well, perhaps that they're social, that they have long memories, that they have relationships with each other that are important to them and to the world, for that matter, and also their survival skills, how extremely aware they are of everything that is going on around them, how they pay close attention to everything, and how they're very quick to respond to any stimulus that they hear. They're quite wonderful animals.
Now, you mentioned that they're social, but how do deer communicate with each other, and how do deer hierarchies work?
All the deer family has the same general pattern, which is female. Well, many ungulates do. They have large, well-organized groups of females, and that would be a mother, a grandmother, with the grandmother in the leadership role, then the sisters and daughters, and the young children of these females. And the male herds are, the male groups are usually one or more large mature males with younger males following them. The male groups are sort of more scattered. They're not cohesive. They may be two or three today and four tomorrow and one tomorrow and the next day too. But the female herds stay together, and they're usually always the same, the same number. The same group stays together.
And how do they communicate with each other?
Well, I think there's a lot of olfactory communication with deer. They have, but also body language, and of some sound. They make some vocal noises, not very many. Mostly it's scent. A lot of communication comes from scent, but the rest, the immediate communication, comes from body language.
What do you learn about humans from writing about deer?
Well, sort of how obtuse we are. We don't know half the stuff that they know. I mean, I consider myself pretty good in the woods, but I don't have a patch on the deer, or what they know about things. I mean, following a deer, or just there's one thing in my book about how I found, I saw a deer. I came up a ridge and in the woods, and a deer stood up at the top of the ridge and left the bed where she had been lying. And I went and got into the bed to see what she had been seeing. And and she could see down both sides of the ridge. She could see a huge amount, but nobody could see her. Now, how do you know that place, that particular place, because there aren't any other places like that? And she knew it. And it was that kind of knowledge that so many wild animals have, or so many, whoever lives in the natural world has to have that kind of knowledge. And the deer are just one of the folks who do.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners about deer?
Well, I would respect them. I think they're very remarkable creatures, and I think they're deserving of our deep respect.
Well, it's been great having you on the show today. Again, you've been listening to Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, the author of a new book called The Hidden Life of Deer, Lessons from the Natural World. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Anne Mesnikoff, the Sierra Club's clean cars expert. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Anne, there is big news that we're hearing out of Washington, D.C. recently. Tell us what's going on with the fuel economy standards.
Well, yesterday the administration announced really historic fuel economy standards and, in fact, the first national greenhouse gas standards to reduce global warming pollution from America's cars and light trucks.
So what does this mean for consumers? How much money will they be saving? And, what are the real differences that they're going to see in fuel economy?
Well, right now the average car, the standard for the average car is 27.5 miles per gallon. Many cars actually do better than that, and some do worse. By 2016, cars will average around 39 miles per gallon, which is a real change for consumers in terms of how much they spend at the gas pump.
Sure.
And how much pollution is coming out of the tailpipe of their vehicle.
So what does this mean for global warming? I mean, is there like an equivalent of the number of cars that's like taking off the road?
The administrator of the EPA announced that this would be the equivalent of taking 42 million cars off the road. So we expect some real big changes in terms of how much oil we're using and how much global warming pollution we're emitting from America's cars and light trucks. After all, just our vehicles alone emit 20% of U.S. CO2 emissions, so we have a lot of progress to make.
Now, you know, there are some people who worry that this is going to put the automakers out of business. How do you respond to that?
Well, importantly, the automakers are on board with this decision and are supportive of these increases. They joined with President Obama on May 19th at the White House when these new standards were announced. And the fact is the auto industry has the technology. They have better engines. They have better transmissions. They have high-strength, lightweight materials. They have low-rolling resistance tires. They have better lubricants. There's a whole bunch of technologies that are available to the industry to give consumers better choices at the dealerships starting now. And so really it's time to move forward, and I think the auto industry is ready to do that rather than the way the industry has fought standards in the past.
Anything else our listeners should know about this new fuel economy standard that was announced this week?
Well, I think it's important for the public to know that there's an opportunity to weigh in on these standards for the next 60 days. People can look at the standards that EPA and the Department of Transportation have proposed and give their view of these. I think it's important for our government to hear from people that we want better fuel economy, that it's time for the auto manufacturers to give it to us, and that these standards are a start but not an end to improving fuel economy.
And where can our listeners go for more information?
For more information on how to respond to these fuel economy standards and get engaged in giving public comment, folks can go to sierraclub.org/transportation, and we'll have information there for you as soon as we can.
Well, thanks so much for telling us about this good news. You have been listening to Anne Mesnikoff, the Sierra Club's clean cars expert in Washington, D.C. Joining us now in our studio is Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tomatoes are everywhere in the farmers markets these days. Let's talk about some of your favorite recipe ideas for tomatoes.
Well, a couple of my favorite tomatoes are what are called early girls, which are a small tomato packed with flavor, not too juicy, but just so sweet and so delicious. And the great thing about early girls is they start early and they run late. I often call them late girls when we're still running them in October, late October. And right now we have a salad on the menu with a really delicious avocado, early girl tomatoes, just wedges and slices of them. The little sweet 100 and sun gold cherry tomatoes, just a simple lime vinaigrette, which is olive oil, lime juice, a little lime zest, and pumpkin seeds, which are spiced pumpkin seeds. We've just toasted pumpkin seeds with a bit of olive oil, a little cumin, a bit of cayenne, and toast those up until they're crispy and nice. And if you'd like, we are also adding like a shaved dry jack cheese to that, but salad can be made without, or you can also use ricotta salata or any great fresh cheese that you like to eat with avocado and tomato. And we're serving that just with a few lettuces, cilantro sprigs. It's just very simple, very fresh, very delicious.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
It's Saturday. You and your wife take the boys to the mall, straight to the food court. Your wife and Pete head for tacos. You and Danny want Chinese. You look up at the menu for a few seconds. You look down to see what Danny wants. But you don't see Danny. Your eyes dart around frantically. You instinctively call out,
Danny! Danny!
From the taco place, you hear a voice.
Hey, Dad! Change my mind!
Every parent knows that feeling when, even for a few seconds, you lose sight of your child. Imagine if he or she were actually abducted. Go to wirelessamberalerts.org. Sign up for free Amber Alerts on your cell phone. When an Amber Alert is issued in the areas you've chosen, you'll receive a free text message. If you spot the vehicle, the suspect, or the child described in the alert, call 911. Sign up today at wirelessamberalerts.org. A child is calling for help. This message brought to you by the Wireless Foundation, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Ad Council.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
89.3 WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in. You're listening to One Chord to Another, the show where every week you will hear great indie rock and pop from great indie rock and pop artists, new and old. I'm your host, Jeff, and I've got an especially fun show today because in addition to great music, later in the show, I'll be giving away a pair of passes to Ghostly Manor, a haunted house that sounds pretty impressive, if you ask me. The number you're going to need for that, or to call in and make a request or a comment, is always 845-9676. That's option one, or you can call toll-free at 800-585-4322. That's extension 9676. Right now, let's get into some music. This is a band I've been really getting into lately. I just love their sound so much. It's the United States of Electronica. Here is River of Love on the station making waves, WHFR.FM.